This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On this Monday morning, it's June the 10th. It's a public holiday where I am in Victoria. It's the King's birthday. And on that note, we acknowledge that Pacific Beat is coming to you in the Pacific from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Evan Wasuka, standing in for Agnes Tupou. Today on the show, Fiji's police force is in for major changes as the government looks to root out corruption and fight a major drug war.
And through this process, we will be able to coordinate better as a whole of nation in terms of how we deal with our drug problems, and hopefully in as much as we can to eradicate this problem.
And in Vanuatu, the government there is anticipating a reset of its own in politics. But first, it'll need a national referendum to go its way. We'll have the latest on Vanuatu's referendum. The Pacific Arts Festival is on in Hawaii and is attracting big political players, including U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell.
A huge part of what we're trying to do is make clear that our agenda is broad and deep, and it's meant to address the specific concerns of the peoples of the Pacific, and I'd stand on that record.
We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, on the show today, as the response to the Enga landslide in Papua New Guinea enters a third week, the humanitarian effort is turning its focus towards helping vulnerable people traumatized by the disaster. PNG's Directorate for Social Change and Mental Health has dispatched a team to offer mental health support for survivors and relief workers. As Kyle Evans reports, child-friendly centres for displaced children have been set up.
As the dust settles following the Enga landslide, children are among the most vulnerable.
So based on some of the data that's come out, we do have some children who are living with special needs, some children who have lost their parents, others who have been traumatized and obviously are in a different kind of state of mind.
Karen Polly is the operations director at Care International PNG. She's heading up an assessment team to set up child-friendly spaces near the disaster site to help support traumatised and displaced children. Karen says the centres will be set up in tents and will act like temporary schools or daycare centres.
One of the biggest, I guess, challenge for us is to find a flat space that can take, you know, the size of the tent. It's about 42 square centimetres. So we just need somewhere that's flat and safe and probably closer to an infrastructure that's already established, such as a school or a hospital, so that there's also other people who will be there. Another thing that we need to consider is the water source for children, their hygiene needs as well. So those are other things that, again, we're working very closely with UNICEF, who have had experience to set up child-friendly spaces, and we're getting their support on that.
A key component for Karen and her team will be the recruitment of local volunteers who can speak to the children in their local dialect. Karen says they'll rely on them to work with the children to carry out recreational and educational activities.
Each of the tents, the child-friendly spaces, there will be different groups and they'll be characterised according to their age range. And then we would need to have different volunteers who can carry out those activities for a specific group of children. Ideally, we would very much like to engage volunteers from the community, but at the same time, we appreciate that these volunteers have also gone through trauma. So that's another level that we also need to be very sensitive to.
Care International PNG Country Director Justine McMahon expects the centres to remain open for the duration of the recovery, which could be as long as 6 months.
So we'll be engaging people from that area to work with children. There'll be recreation games, there'll be education kits. It'll be a safe and a friendly atmosphere for children to begin that process of recovery.
PNG's Directorate of Social Change and Mental Health Services has also sent staff to help survivors, as well as frontline health workers to cope with the stress the disaster has brought about. The agency's director is Dr. Uma Rambi.
You do react very abnormally because of such situations. So emotionally you can have shock, fear, anger, sadness, shame. And physically, you can also have issues with sleep and physical problem, like you get shocked and startled and agitated, irritable, palpitations, and so on. And even in thinking, it can create some negative thinking in your brain. You might have seeing images and dreams and confusion because difficulty to make decisions. And what happens as a result, you have behavior issues. You might have withdrawn, feeling detached and loss of interest in things. And you may not want to work, very fatigued, and want to drink alcohol or cigarette or other kind of drugs.
The sheer scale of the disaster makes it a difficult task, but Dr. Ambi says the directorate is well placed to respond. In April, the directorate trained 15 workers from the Enga Provincial Health Authority in primary mental health care and disaster management. She says they'll be well placed to help those on the ground.
We will collaborate together. They've already got the knowledge and they, you know, so it's no time to like training. I'm happy we have already trained. So when they go there, they are going to deal with the people, those who are affected, the victims, the children, the mothers, orphans, and things, you know, those who have lost their loved ones in that landslide, and also provide services to service providers. Like, you know, like those who are relief workers also can have mental health issues, you know, digging dead bodies and all those things. People also can have issues. So we'll be providing services to the affected people and the work, you know, the relief workers and whoever need at the site and wherever they need to get more help, they can always get help from us.
That's Dr. Uma Ambi from PNG's Directorate of Social Change and Mental Health Services. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It's a pivotal day in Vanuatu's history with the results of a historical referendum to be announced later today. The referendum, which took place on May 29, aimed to get public endorsement for changes to the constitution to bring about political stability. Joining us this morning from Port Vila is Stevenson Liu, editor for Vanuatu's Broadcasting Television Corporation. Good morning, Stevenson, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Evans, and thank you for having me.
Great. Look, Stevenson, what's the mood like in Port Vila this morning? Is there much anticipation for the referendum result?
Yeah, it is. Now, the level of anticipation is quite higher because there's been a lot of discussion around the intention of the amendment and the following legal case that went to court in order to challenge the amendment. Now, the people of Vanuatu are, of course, tired of political instability too, and they're looking forward to something to stop it. And they believe the two amendments might make a difference. But again, it remains to be seen today.
Now, before we get into the case and the referendum itself, tell us a bit about the question people were asked to decide on when Vanuatu went to the referendum on May 29.
Yeah, there are actually two questions that people were asked. The first one on the amendment under Article 17A. Now, that is about the member of parliament that actually or who resigns or is terminated. And the amendment seeks the president of the political party to inform the speaker of parliament within 14 days if a member resigns from his or her political party, and that is that the speaker terminates the and declare the seat vacant. That's on 17A, and with 17B it seeks the vacation of seat of an independent member. Now, the article specifies that after a general election, a member who contests as an independent or is voted in as a single member of a political party will need to declare the affiliation into a registered political party within 3 months, actually. And if they don't do that, then the seats will be declared vacant. So those are the two those are the two amendments that people were asked to do vote for. Now, again, there were a lot of anticipation because, of course, we know that all these hinges on the fact that the single party members and independents were actually the ones moving about in parliament and causing all the instability. So, yeah, those are the two questions that were put forward to the citizens.
Now, Stevenson, the voting for the referendum went pretty smoothly on May 29, and then we had it happen in overseas as well. How has the counting gone, and how has it gone according to schedule?
It is, I would say it has, because immediately after the announcement of a referendum, the government went ahead and did some amendment to the Referendum Act, allowing it to extend the days and the hours, simply so that everybody could cast their vote, especially overseas. We have workers in PALM and SWP as well, and RSC as well. So they've been allowed time in order to vote after working hours. So that gave them enough time to vote and get the ballots over to Bert Vila for counting. So the counting went for the entire week and went into the night, and all the ballot boxes from overseas arrived on Friday and were counted over the weekend. So yeah, there was time for every ballot to arrive in order for that counting to go ahead. So of course, I would say they went pretty deep into the night in order to count all the ballots. So they've done that over the weekend. And so later today, we're expecting the results.
Stevenson, you mentioned the workers in Australia and in New Zealand. How did Vanuatu officials deal with those in New Caledonia? Because we had that issue in Numea with the riots and the political problems. How were people there able to vote? How did they manage to deal with that problem?
They've actually voted, and we had officials from Vanuatu Elections who went there to conduct the voting. So the voting took place in the consulate building in Numea. It went pretty smoothly, so there was no disturbance there. So the amendment to the Referendum Act was specifically so that New Caledonians can vote, considering that there is political instability there as well. So they've been allowed time to extend the 14 hours for New Caledonia, and they did vote, and they got the results back in time.
Now, Stevenson, like you said, counting has gone according to plan, went late into the night. How will the results be announced today? Will it be broadcast live on TV? Can you take us through what the plan is?
Yeah, it will be broadcast live on TV. VPTC has allocated time for that. And, of course, they've been streaming. The electoral office has been streaming since the sorting out and the counting of ballots. So they are definitely taking that live as well. So, yeah, the announcement will come later today when that will happen. But, yes, we are preparing to go live with that.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. And on the line with me from Port Vila is Stevenson Liu. He's the editor for Vanuatu Broadcasting and Television. Now, Stevenson, today we're expecting to hear the results. What will happen once the results come out? What do we expect to hear?
As soon as the results come out, they will need to be gazetted. And when that's done, then we will see that implemented. Now, there's a court case pending as well for the challenge to the political party integrity bill. Now, that act is quite important to the entire amendment because it talks about the political party registrations. It talks about the constitutional the constitutions of the political parties, which may be used when it comes to deciding the vacancy of seats as well. So the amendments actually are important, but they hinge quite a bit on the Political Party Registration Act, which is being challenged in court. Now, that act went to court with the challenge to the amendments themselves, but the court has decided it is not an urgent case, so it was delayed to August 19th. So it remains to be seen, given that there are legal cases pending as well. So the appeal court on the challenge of the amendment itself is also scheduled for appeal in August. Now, but of course, a referendum is something that's been decided, and it's within the constitution. So whatever happens, it remains to be seen based on the constitutional court challenges.
Stevenson, it's certainly an interesting and complex case there in Vanuatu with the referendum and then the multiple court challenges also lined up. Look, before we wrap up for today, what's your feeling about are people keen to see change and with the referendum there, or are there reservations around it?
Yeah, I think the people are keen actually to see some changes to the political activities in the country. We've had three prime ministers in the span of 6 months, and so that's a bit of a concern for Vanuatu. And Vanuatu has been hit by a lot of political instability for quite some time now. So people are expecting to see some changes, and of course, how it happens, it depends on the actual result of the referendum. But of course, we know that this is not a silver bullet, and anything can happen, you know. But it's something that people are looking forward for, and people are actually wanting some changes in terms of political stability in the country. So yeah, everybody is looking ahead for something different after today.
Stevenson, thank you very much for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Stevenson Liu. He's the news editor for Vanuatu Broadcasting Television Corporation.
Nation 40. Hosted by me, Sam Wicks.
And me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nation 40 stars.
Nation 40. Nation Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Hold the front page!
It's that time of the morning to take a look at the headlines from across the region. And joining me this morning is producer Finau Fonua. Good morning, Finau.
Good morning, Evan.
Well, let's start off in rugby. And the Fijian Drua were unable to pull off an upset against the Blues in the quarterfinals of the Super Rugby competition at Eden Park. So they went down 36-5. Finau, you watched the game. What happened?
They were just outclassed, plain and simple. The Blues dominated the first half, scoring three tries in the form of Dalton Papali'i, Finlay Christie and Caleb Clark. They went into the break with a 22-0 lead. The Drua looked like they were fighting back. Celestino Ravotamanda scored a brilliant try just 3 minutes into the second half, but they weren't able to capitalize on that momentum, the Blues scoring two tries in the final quarter. So just not much. The Blues will host the Brumbies next week. It'll be an interesting game.
Yeah, I guess it was too much for the Fijian Drua to take on Auckland in Eden Park. A bit of a daunting task there. It'll be interesting to see what happens next with the because the Fijian Drua, most of the squad is in the Fijian, the Flying Fijian. So we'll see where they go to next on that. But yeah, keen to see how the semifinals of the Super Rugby unfold in the coming weeks. Now, heading back into news, we're hearing that reports that the death toll of the riots in New Caledonia now has increased to 8 after a man died from his wounds. What more do we know, Finau?
Yes, 9 news reports a man died from his wounds a week after he was shot by French law enforcement. The victim was one of 2 armed men who rammed a pickup truck into a car carrying French soldiers. They opened fire on them. Both men were shot when those soldiers returned fire, according to a statement from the territory's prosecutor. That's the 8th victim of the violent riots that have rocked Noumea over the last month. As you know, the riots occurred after France decided to consider allowing French-born migrants to vote in New Caledonia elections.
Yeah, a really interesting situation. The death toll there has gone up. I've also saw in the news this morning that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, he's also called a snap election in France. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts on the situation in New Caledonia. So we'll be certainly keeping an eye on that story. Now, heading over to probably the biggest event happening right now, the Pacific Festival of Arts. We're hearing that the capital cities of Hawaii and Cook Islands are now sister cities, if you know.
Yes, it certainly is a symbol of solidarity. Hawaii Spectrum News reports a historic sister city signing took place at the opening of the Festival Village for the 13th Festival of Pacific Arts and Culture in Honolulu last Friday. Honolulu Mayor Rick Biangiardi signed the agreement with Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown at the Hawaii Convention Center. Prime Minister Mark Brown told Cook Islands News, quote, "I hope our substantial presence here at FESPAC, our signing of this sister city partnership today and performances at the Polynesian Cultural Center will support improved performance and growth, inbound visitors from Honolulu and the 15 U.S. gateways that connect to Honolulu." But I think, you know, we've been covering this festival over the last week, and we've seen the solidarity between all the Polynesian countries and the Melanesian, Micronesian countries as well.
Yeah, it's certainly been a celebration of culture and tradition. And you can find it all on the ABC Pacific Facebook page. We have a team there, and all the sights, sounds, and images are captured right there on ABC Pacific on Facebook. For now, thank you very much for the update on the latest headlines from across the region.
Thank you so much.
That was Finau Funua with our news wrap.
Pacific Beat.
As Fiji's authorities battle a major drugs crisis, the government has announced a reset to the police force. The changes, backed by Australia, are aimed at rooting out corruption and restoring integrity and efficiency in the men in blue. The ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lithe Movono, takes a look at the changes.
Fiji's police force is at the front line fighting a drugs crisis that's seen a surge in illegal drug imports and a spike in domestic drug use. Pia Tikundundua, Fiji's minister in charge of public security and law enforcement, believes that fight is being hampered by corruption within the ranks of the police force.
Our president explains a lot about what our past has been. And we want to do something about it, you know. Talking about the past right now is not as important about talking about the way forward. This is the way forward. So hopefully through this initiative and through this process, we will be able to coordinate better as a whole of nation in terms of how we deal with our drug problems, and hopefully in as much as we can to eradicate this problem.
A key part of that reset is working closer with the Australian Federal Police to boost the capacity of Fiji's police force.
Today I would like to announce that I intend to implement a full reset of the Fiji Police Force. Now, this reset will have several components. First, it will be guided by the development of a new overarching strategy for the Fiji Police Force. This strategy will identify key priorities and the core values that are essential building blocks to a high-performing police force to shape the way forward.
Minister Tikandu Ndua says the agreement will come into force once he gets cabinet endorsement for a new agreement between Fiji and Australia. A new memorandum of association is being drawn up following the minister's meetings with Australian Federal Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw, Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong, and Minister for the Pacific Pat Conroy.
Now, the new MOU will supersede the previous MOU that was signed in 2022. This new agreement will facilitate closer cooperation through a number of avenues, including police exchanges between Fiji and Australia, starting at the executive level. We will now commence development of this new MOU as a key priority. Once complete, I will present this new MOU to Cabinet for consideration and endorsement before it is signed with Australia.
Fiji's police force has been the subject of negative publicity. The former commissioner is now in jail after he was found guilty of abuse of office for influencing a police investigation at the behest of former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama. Jukifong Chu is the acting commissioner of police. He says the reset will provide a map for whoever leads the police force.
And within the organisation, we have officers that have served longer than the commissioner that have come in to lead the organization. And usually there are opinions within the organization. So when there are opinions, differences, you know, things doesn't come together.
Under the new agreement, Australian police will be part of Fiji's new Narcotics Bureau. Mentors will be provided for strategic positions within the police force, such as intelligence, human resources, and operational planning. And the new Commissioner of Police, when selected, will also have an Australian mentor.
The Australian counterparts are coming here as mentor for those who will be leaders in the police force who are Fijians. Okay. The whole reason of the reset is, you know, the question that was posed earlier, is looking at everything across the whole police force.
That's Fiji's Home Affairs Minister, Pio Tikandu Ndua, ending that report from Lithe Mavono in Suva.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It's been a sea of colour, dance and culture at the 13th Festival of Arts in Hawaii. The event has also attracted Pacific leaders, as well as the United States' second most powerful diplomat, the Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell. Mr. Campbell says his presence at FestPAC is to forge real connections with the Pacific. The host of the ABC's Pacific TV program, Johnson Rayala, caught up with a senior diplomat.
When I joined the Biden administration this time, one of the things that the president asked me to do, working with a strong team across the U.S. government, is to up our game in the Pacific. And for me personally, having served in the Pacific, my father served during the Second World War in the Pacific. I have a deep emotional connection. I think the United States has historical, moral, and strategic reasons to do more. And so I've been grateful to be able to do a lot with our team to step up our game. And we've done much of that with Australian friends and partners, and I'm very grateful for that. And I just hope to continue that going forward.
You know, whether it's true or not, there's a perception among Pacific Islanders and Pacific leaders that America's presence in the Pacific is just about security, and about countering China. What would you say to people in the region about this, who feel this way?
Well, I mean, I would say come to PacFest. I mean, we've been here for the last 3 days. We've been talking about people to people, about climate change, about illegal fishing, about jobs, about opportunities, about health care. These are the issues that the Pacific wants to think and talk about. And so a huge part of what we're trying to do is make clear that our agenda is broad and deep, and it's meant to address the specific concerns of the peoples of the Pacific. And I'd stand on that record.
Mm. In March, you said that American hearts are heavy. Hearts are heavy for the tragic burden of the nuclear tests that the Marshallese must carry.
Yeah.
Yet the latest compact agreement has been criticised for failing to make any new or substantial steps towards resolving the nuclear legacy issues, and that the trust fund agreement doesn't even mention the word nuclear. Now, Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine even went so far to say that America was gradually destroying relations. Does the US expect that the Marshall Islands to carry this nuclear burden on its own going forward?
Well, let me just say that I think the truth is that the United States historically has made very substantial commitments to address the tragic nuclear legacy. We're going to continue to do that through a variety of ways. And you see manifestations of our commitment that are throughout the compact as it has been negotiated more directly. I think the truth is that we're going to have to continue to deal with these through a variety of engagements. I will say, if you look at the nature of the compacts that they've been negotiated, it's a very substantial uptick in resources across the board that also deals with the health and welfare of the people there. I stand by our commitments to recognize that this is a tragic legacy that we must acknowledge and reflect on regularly.
We spoke about this a little bit inside the room, but when we look at nuclear testing weapons in the Pacific, remains a vexed issue. Now, the effects are still being felt today. But when we look at AUKUS, you know, there's the agreement that we'll likely see more high-end nuclear-powered submarines operating in the region. How do you reassure Pacific people that it is about equal relations and not just security?
Well, look, I think the AUKUS arrangement is designed to provide nuclear-powered but conventionally armed submarines to Australia. I think this is something that we've worked on in conjunction with partnership with Great Britain, the United States, and Australia. It is true that this pact is primarily about security, but I would simply say each of the three countries are deeply committed to an open and free Indo-Pacific and are determined to take steps at the very highest level to assure nuclear security and safety. You've seen that at the IAEA and through a variety of other engagements. And I think the United States, Australia, and Great Britain are committed to undertake this partnership in a way that it is fully in line with international law and is also transparent to our peoples and the peoples of the Pacific.
Sorry, and just quickly, just lastly, let's look at FISPAC specifically. Mm-hmm. What has been you've been here for a couple of days. You were at the opening ceremony last night. What's been a highlight for you?
There's been a lot of things. I gotta say, I was pretty moved by the Tonga delegation coming in. I don't think I've ever seen such a ruckus, and it was pretty powerful. I liked also, again, we were talking in our earlier session. There's a tendency, Americans sometimes think of the Pacific as kind of all the same, but the diversity of cultural heritage, of languages, of traditions is remarkable. And so what I was struck by was both the sense of unity, but also the diversity that was on very clear display over the last couple of days. I love that, and I look forward to coming back again.
That's the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, speaking there to the ABC's Johnson Raiola at the Pacific Festival of Arts in Hawaii.
Tune in to SBS Samoa News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoa News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoa News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in the Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka, standing in for Agnes Tupou on this Monday morning. Now, earlier in the show, we heard about the plan for Australia to support Fiji's police force, where mentors would be brought in to support their Fijian counterparts. But here in Australia, Papua New Guinea cadets have been part of a new training initiative with police in North Queensland. The ABC's Jess Naunton went along to a special ceremony to speak to some of those cadets.
My name is Mo Evara Koivi. I'm a cadet officer with the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary. I was with the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary as a constable for almost 6 years prior to joining the cadet program.
And what have you learnt whilst being here?
We do policing differently in Papua New Guinea, and being here, it's given me a different perspective from how I do policing back in Papua New Guinea. And being here, a lot of the things we do it the same, but we tend to lack in some of the areas where in leadership and supervision. And being here, especially after passing graduating from the college, I would be an inspector. And being here, the way the members are being supervised and looked after is it's prioritized. And as for me, I'll take back that with me and going back to Papua New Guinea.
What are some of the things that you've been able to do whilst being here in Townsville?
I was at the Watch House. It's pretty different from how we do things in Papua New Guinea. So it was very interesting seeing how detainees are brought in, registered, and kept in the cells and taken to court. It takes a while for our detainees to get to court, but here it's really fast. So that's something that when I get out there on the field, I would try to emphasize to my police officers after passing out.
What have you been able to teach some of the officers here about Papua New Guinea?
Yeah, I found football interesting. We had a lot in common talking about football, but I try to teach them a little bit of our language, Tokpisin. It's been okay. That's it. I tried to learn.
How did they go, really, more?
Well, it's quite funny. But they're trying to pick up on some of the language. It's a little bit the same, but we have a broken type of English that we call Tokpisin. Yes, it was good.
So now that you're finished with the cadetship here, what happens for you when you go back to Papua New Guinea?
It's a three-year program, so far we've gone through probably 9 months. So I've got another 2 years to go before I graduate as an inspector.
Is there anything else that you're hoping to pick up as part of the cadet program and learn?
Me personally, coming over here, I didn't know what to expect, but I just wanted to take on the challenge coming here and see how things are done. And so far, it's been so good. I've learned a lot, especially in the way the officers here conduct themselves. At first, I asked one of the officers, "Are you guys really patient with how you deal with the offenders here?" But then, as the days gone on, I've realized that it's not being patient with them, but it's been professional in how they conduct their jobs. So that is something that I will take back with me.
How important is the relationship between Papua New Guinea and Australia?
Oh, it's very important. It dates back to the World War. But going forward, we're a developing country, and we need the assistance, all the assistance we can get as a country. But in policing-wise, having the AFB with us has really helped a lot, especially in training and getting us equipped to meeting the standards of dealing with criminal activities. But it's very important for us to, and being here with the Queensland Police, it's very good, and I just hope that this can continue and have more police officers come over here and experience how it's like to do policing on a professional level.
Do you want to give a shout-out to anyone back home?
Yeah, I just want to say a big hello to all my colleagues back in Bomana. They'll be coming down shortly, but it's been a really good experience here, and I know that coming over you'll also enjoy it as I've did. Just to my family, to my wife and daughters here, a big hello to all of you, and see you soon.
And that is PNG Police Cadet Moa Ivara Kwaivi, and he's looking forward to implementing his Queensland Police training back home. He was speaking there with the ABC's Jess Naunton. An artist is paying tribute to Nauru and other parts of the Pacific in a major exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia in Sydney. In A World Undone, Nicholas Mangan explores Australia's place in the Pacific region. He tells Dubravka Volodare that his work suggests new perspectives on pressing issues, such as the impact of mining on natural resources and climate change.
This iteration at the Museum of Contemporary Art consists of two coffee tables and a rock on a wooden crate. And these coffee tables are made from coral limestone, and they were brought over as large pinnacle rocks, symbols of prosperity, and they adorned the entry court. On the high-rise tower on 80 Collins Street in Melbourne. And I knew nothing about Nauru and came across these pinnacles, and they looked very much out of place and somewhat somber. And I soon learned that Nauru had sort of lost that building due to financial bankruptcy. And not long after that, the pinnacles were taken away. And I was really interested to know where these pinnacles had gone. I learned that they'd been taken to the backyard of Helen Bogdan, who was the spokesperson for Nauru House, and had also been involved with helping the Nauruans sue the Australian government for damages that had ensued under Australia's strip mining of Nauru for phosphate. Around the same time, I was also doing some other more extensive research into the history of Nauru and learnt that at that time, the then President Bernard Dowiogo was quoted by an American journalist as saying that he planned to take the remaining pinnacles that were left on Nauru once all the fertilizer had been gouged out and spread all over the kind of British Empire. He planned to turn those pinnacles into ancient coral coffee tables to be sold on the US market. And I'm not sure if this was a tongue-in-cheek story or not, but I thought it was an interesting way to sort of enter into this particular history of Nauru and sort of produce a monument to Nauru itself. And these coffee tables kind of very much echo the kind of strip mining or flattening of the Nauruan island and its kind of remaining barren-like lunar landscape. And you can see on the top of these tables, you can see this kind of very beautiful and intricate coral inlay that is mixed in with this limestone, so that the works themselves sort of became a way to kind of speak to that particular history of Nauru.
And when we come into that room, they have quite a prominent place in that space. When we look to our left there, we can also see references to that history, can't we?
Well, yes, there's on the wall a framed piece, which is just a singular stamp, which is a kind of a Nauruan stamp that kind of commemorates the moon landing. And I guess I was also interested to go to Nauru because on the website at that time, it was Nauru was promoting tourism, saying, come and visit the lunar-like landscape. And I thought, that's kind of a very dark form of tourism, given that it's a kind of was a very barren and arid and hot landscape with not much more than just these large coral pinnacles that had sort of forced the Nauruans to the very edge of their island. And this particular stamp is somebody else, as one of the curators of the exhibition, Annika Jasper, observed, is that it's perhaps standing on. It's the perspective you see is the edge of the moon, but it's viewing back to Earth, perhaps looking directly at Nauru in the Pacific. And I just thought that was a really poignant stamp because I know that the Nauruans were at one point were very much interested in stamp collection, but it was also important to me because I went to Nauru myself and took up this invitation to visit the lunar-like landscape, but mainly to send back a message to Australia of the devastation that had been caused under Australia's colonial occupation.
That was my next question. You are looking at Australia's place in the Pacific through this exhibit. Why do you think that's important?
I think it's really important because I guess, I think Australia needs to understand its history and what it's done and what its involvement has been in our so-called neighbouring islands. I mean, this continues today through various other forms of, soft power and whatnot. But there was a particular, and I guess it continues through mining, it's not only that we're mining ourselves, but we're also taking that extractive behaviour and have taken that extractive behaviour to other places and kind of force that on to particular countries or islands. And I think it's really important that history is told and is kept in the public imagination, because I think we're entering into a new era at the moment with new forms of kind of so-called green energy, and these behaviours are likely to kind of double down.
So we have that theme of climate change in the Great Barrier Reef as well. And if we go to the other side of the exhibition, we can see reference to that, can't we?
It's interesting because in my projects or through my investigations, I started deep here in the Pacific in Nauru and then moved over to Bougainville for the Bougainville Civil War that was centred around the Panguna copper mine. And only just recently I've come back to Australia to sort of investigate this kind of issue of mass bleaching and the coral mortality rates that are happening, which is devastating both to the reefs, but also it's sort of somewhat of a, like a metaphor for what's going to happen to the humans in terms of like not being able to withstand the increased temperatures that are expected to come. The barrier itself is kind of, it's interesting as a metaphor, as this thing of protection, but it also is this thing of fragility. It was Captain Cook's colonial vessel, the Endeavour, was ensnared on it, and a piece of coral got wedged in its hull, apparently. And so I guess I'm just interested in this kind of playing around this notion of the barrier and this idea of protection, or how coral is somehow seems to capture the human imagination, and it's also elicits a sense of kind of empathy. Maybe it's because coral is both plant, animal and mineral, there is this kind of connection to the human.
And that was artist educator Nicholas Mangan talking there to Dubravka Volodare.
Pacific Beat.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this Monday morning. It's time to take a look back at our top story for today. And it's a pivotal day in Vanuatu's history, with the results of a historical referendum to be announced later today. The referendum aims to get changes to the country's constitution and bring about political stability. We spoke to Stevenson Liu, the editor of Vanuatu Broadcasting and Television Corporation, who told us that there is a public mood for change.
The people of Vanuatu are, of course, tired of political instability too, and they're looking forward to something to stop it.
That's Stevenson Liu. He is the editor of Vanuatu Broadcasting and Television Corporation. And that wraps up our show for this morning. I'm Evan Wasuka with you on this Monday morning. Agnes Tupou will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. Papua New Guinea time. But join us later today with Richard Ewart at 3 p.m. Papua New Guinea time for the afternoon session of Pacific Beat. Thank you for your company and have a great Monday morning.